appreciate each one that's determined not to go back. I'm determined too, by the grace of God, to not go back. And if we're not going to go back, that means that we must be focused on going forward. So I want to be there. I want to be going forward in my walk with the Lord. And I want all of us to be there. I'd like to speak to us about something this morning that it's a technique, I guess you would say, that the devil would like to try to use even more than he already has. And Drew went out this morning and kind of looked at some of our fruit trees and other trees, and he came back and he said, the little buds are starting on the trees. So we know that green grass is right around the corner, so to speak. Spring will be here. We might have some cold weather next few weeks, but spring is going to be here before we know it. We're going to have the blossoms next to our steps going into the back of the house. We have some, what do you call those things? Irises, lilies, some, that's right there by the steps. And I noticed this morning that they're up about 3/4 of an inch out of the ground. The little green is starting to push up. So just as spring is coming, naturally, and we expect growth, we've made some significant progress here in the chapel, and we want to see this job done. And why are we doing this? We're anticipating growth, right? So I want to talk to us about a technique the enemy has to inhibit that. And what I want to talk to us about is the demise of unity. That would be my title if I was going to give it one. And I'll have to ask you if anyone here is good at speed reading, because we're going to cover about 9 chapters in the Bible this morning. I found out something about my wife when we got married, after we got married, that if she read a book, she didn't read it like I did. She would pick up, I'm not talking about the Bible, okay, but if she picked up a book just to read a story, whether it was whatever kind of story it was, she just kind of skimmed through it. She could finish a book a lot quicker than me. And when we would finish, we didn't always have the same details. And sometimes when she would read through a book, it was like there's just too many pages. You know, you just kind of read the first page and the last page of the chapter. Not really, but, you know, just you kind of get the idea. And, my, you can get done with a book pretty quick that way. And I was the type, if I was going to read a book, I read every word. You know, I just felt like I wasn't doing it right if I didn't read every word. Okay, so I'm not going to ask that you read every word, but I'm going to try to give you some kind of summarized of what I feel like is the overall part of these chapters. And we'd like to turn to the book of 2 Samuel, and I would like to turn to a story that we all are familiar with. However, we look at this story, it's not a real positive place, but we're picking up the story of David being the king of Israel. This was not his first day on the job. He had been a king now of Israel for a period of time. I'm not going to tell you that I know exactly how long. I know that David was king in Israel just slightly over 40 years. He's credited with uniting all of the tribes and bringing them together as a real force to be contended with. He was a man that conquered a lot of opposition during his reign. And in the 11th chapter of the book of 2 Samuel, we have the story of David and Bathsheba. And I know that we know a lot of the details of that story. And remember, the subject we want to talk about is the demise of unity. Alright? So David here in the story in the 11th chapter had a great personal failure, did he not? He failed in his integrity before the Lord. He failed as a really being someone that could be looked to and accepted and recognized as a leader of the people. And so in the story, in the 11th chapter, we have the account where David didn't go to battle with his men, but instead he stayed home. And as he was home, he had the opportunity to observe one of his men's spouse bathing. There's a lot of questions here I would have to ask about who all was at fault, but David had the most fault. He was the king. He should have been not putting himself in a place to be vulnerable to this. He ought to have prepared to guard his soul much better than he did. So, however much blame Bathsheba would get in this situation, I'm not here to debate, but the point I want us to make and get a hold of is David had a personal failure. And if we turn to the second, the end result of in the 11th chapter was that his soldier, the man that was in his armed forces, whose spouse he had an affair with, he ended up having him maneuvered in a place where his life was lost in battle. And so not only did he have a personal failure in his own integrity, but he orchestrated one of his own men's death. In any other place, court of law, that would be considered first-degree murder of some sort. David had a lot of guilt and condemnation of himself. It wasn't, other people were used by David to accomplish trying to cover up something that he shouldn't have never done in the first place. So, in the 12th chapter of 2 Samuel, and I'd encourage you to go read all of this because it's good reading. But the 12th chapter of 2 Samuel is where Nathan the prophet visits David. And when Nathan came into David's presence, he began to tell him a story that was an allegory about how it tried to get David to thinking. And it ended up that David recognized his error. And he said, "I have sinned against the Lord." He said that to the prophet. And the Lord accepted his confession. And the Lord helped him to start putting things back together in his personal life. Okay? So David had, I want us to get this, David was the leader. He had personal failure in his life. And now he's recovering from that personal failure. And we're going to turn to the 13th chapter of 2 Samuel. In the 13th chapter of 2 Samuel, if you don't read the other two chapters, you read it and you say, "Well, this is a terrible story. Why is this in the Bible?" But I want to tell you, I feel like the 13th chapter is one of the end results of having of what happened in the 11th chapter. All right. So the 13th chapter has an account of Amnon, one of David's sons, committing a sin almost identical to his father, but it was with his half-sister, Absalom's sister, own sister. And this story, in the 13th chapter, I believe when, you know, my sons see my failures, my sons see my shortcomings, and you as a congregation can see my shortcomings too. And we can see one another's shortcomings. And you know, the enemy wants unity to disappear. And this is one of his techniques, is he uses personal failures that we may all have, that we all do have, that he would like to use those things to destroy unity amongst us as a congregation, amongst the saints of God as a people in this old world, amongst people that profess Christianity all across our nation. And we find in the story in the 13th chapter of 2 Samuel that Amnon followed an example. He followed a pattern of failure that his father made. I don't have a reason here of why he did that, other than the devil was very real in Amnon's life, just like he was in David. He wanted to come and tempt. He wanted them to fail. He wanted them to fall. So he tempted him. He put something in his life there, and Amnon succumbed to temptation. And the end result was that Absalom followed some of his father's example too. He took matters in his own hands, and he orchestrated the slaying of his half-brother Amnon. So at the beginning of the 13th chapter, you have a sin like his father. At the end, you have him being killed by his brother, by Absalom. And one of the things that happens in this account is that the woman involved pleads with him not to follow through with what he's tempted to do. She pleads with him to approach it from a different manner. And he didn't listen to her. You know, and here's what I get out of this. In the nation of Israel, these type of sins were something that was really looked down on. They were something, the New Testament says these kind of things should not be named once among us as professing Christians. And the Israelite nation was taught by the old law to be clean of these kinds of failures. David fell, now his son fell, and Absalom took justice in his own hands, so to speak. His father didn't really, David didn't really come down hard. How could he come down hard on him? You see, he had a failure in his own life. And it was difficult. David had too many wives anyway. But Absalom took matters in his own hand. He orchestrated the slaying of his own brother in the 13th chapter. If we turn to the 14th chapter, we're really speeding through this now. The 14th chapter, we find that Absalom is banished from his homeland, from Jerusalem. And one commentator says he went and lived with his grandfather on his mother's side for about 3 years. And while he was there, Absalom was, you might say, kind of elevated in the people's eyes because he had fixed the problem. Okay? He took matters in his own hands, and he took the violator out of commission. Alright? You want to read that? You can't. But the people began to look on Absalom almost like a hero because he was standing up for what was right. Okay? Stay with me here. So in the 15th chapter of 2 Samuel, Absalom is restored back to his residence. And it even tells us here that he had, I think, three sons and a daughter there. And he did some things that indicates to me that the people were looking on Absalom with quite a bit of favor because, number one, don't you think the people was disappointed in David with his the situation with Bathsheba? I think the people at large was disappointed in him. And here comes Absalom along and he fixed this problem. All right, so he's kind of a hero because they know this is not something that ought to be happening among them. So in the sixth verse of the 15th chapter, I want to read a couple of verses here. And on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Now what Absalom was doing was he was kind of intercepting anybody that would be thinking about coming to the king for wisdom and direction in their life. And he was kind of letting people know that the king was really busy, but, you know, if I was in charge, I would make time for everybody. And he had a personality. He mixed with people well, and he felt like he had a connection with people because he stood up for what was right, you see. And the people gravitated to him, and he says here, and on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. So what the people began to gravitate to him and look to Absalom and probably even went home and said, you know, I wished Absalom was the king. You know, I think people were starting to talk like that behind closed doors. And then in the seventh verse, and it came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said unto the king, I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed unto the Lord in Hebron. Now this verse, I've done quite a bit of background checks on this verse, and many feel that this verse is talking about Absalom. He told King David, I need to go to Hebron to make sacrifice to the Lord. I promised the Lord that if he would restore me back after I killed my brother or had him killed, that I would be pleasing to him. I would offer sacrifices. So now's the time. I need to go and offer my sacrifices of thanksgiving and worship to the Lord. And he said here it says after 40 years. Now, what checking off? David was only king for 40 years, and this didn't start at the very beginning. You know, this episode didn't happen at the very beginning of him being a king. So many feel like that there's a discrepancy in translation, and this most likely was 4 years instead of 40 years. So I'm not here to debate that. I'm just here to tell you that after a period of time of Absalom being back in Jerusalem and portraying himself as accessible and understanding and compassionate and all of that with the people, and he stole the hearts of the people, and this went on for a period of time. That's the point I want us to get out of the 15th chapter. That and he was not honest, okay? He told his father, King David, I want to go to Hebron to worship the Lord. But he sent the message out, y'all come and join with me. And he went to Hebron, all right, but he went there to be anointed king by the people that he had stole their hearts. So they went and they anointed him king. And when David got word of this, you know how it is when you feel like you're a failure. You feel like that, I don't know what to do. And David, and it was his own son. And he, I'm sure he was aware of Absalom being friendly and available to the people over those period of time. He couldn't. I mean, if he was on the roof and seen the neighbor's wife taking a bath, surely he was perceptive enough to know a little bit about what was going on with Absalom. All right, I'm just. That many times David is accredited with having the wisdom of God or the wisdom of angels. If you read through this second book of 2 Samuel, but it says here that David, instead of him rising up and taking an army and going to combat Absalom, what did he do? He packed up his stuff and left and abandoned Jerusalem. And he ended up crossing Jordan River. And he had many loyal people that wanted to follow him. I'm trying to paint a picture this morning of how unity became dead. The demise of unity in Israel. Okay? So as David left, there were some of the priests that wanted to go with him. They wanted to take the ark and all of that. And David said, no, you just go back. You stay at the temple. You stay at your post of duty. But you keep me informed of what Absalom's plans were. So if we go on, at the end of this chapter, we find that David had abandoned Jerusalem and Absalom had came in and taken up residence in the palace and assumed a position of authority and being king. That's quite a change, isn't it? In one chapter. In the 16th chapter, we find that Absalom establishes himself as king in Jerusalem, seemingly with some of the wisest counselors of all time. There was a man there that I won't try to pronounce his name so much, but he was a man that David recognized. He even prayed, Lord, would you somehow entangle or trap this person? He's very wise, and he was on Absalom's side. He was given Absalom wisdom. And so in the 17th chapter, Absalom begins to plot how to overpower David and take his father's life. You see how this is developing? Absalom is, he asked this wise counselor, how would you go about overthrowing David, my father? I got to get rid of him because he might come back. He might try to overthrow me and contest my authority as a king. So he sought counsel, and he determined that he liked one of the counsels better than the other. So Absalom got a bunch of men together, and they pursued David. And they got himself in a position for battle. 17th chapter and the 23rd verse. I want to read this one to you. And when Ahithophel, this was the man that I said I couldn't pronounce his name very well, saw that his counsel, this is the one that David was afraid of for his wise counsel, saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass and arose and gat him home to his house, to his city, and put his household in order and hanged himself and died and was buried in the sepulcher of his father. This man, when he realized that Absalom was not going to follow his advice, he went home, put everything in order where his family knew how to carry on, and went and hung himself. There was a lot of things going on at this. I mean, I don't know what you feel like When you look around the world, but there's uproar going all around. The enemy wants to crowd that uproar right in here, right where we're at today. And so Absalom is plotting to take David's life. In an 18th chapter of 2 Samuel, the battle happens between Absalom and David's men. And we know this account because this is where Absalom's men were being defeated by David's men. And Absalom was riding on a mule, and he rode through some wooded area and got his head and his hair hung up in a tree, and he was hung by the... He was hung. He couldn't get out. He couldn't get loose somehow. Anyway, and this is where David had pled with his men, don't hurt him. Don't hurt my son. After he was already plotting to take his life, he said, don't hurt the young man. Be merciful to him. And Joab was a very ruthless person, and he knew the only way to take care of this was to take his life. And Joab did. Joab took Absalom's life. And so the battle ended up with Absalom dead. And David went into mourning in the 18th chapter, in the first part of the 19th chapter. David was mourning the loss of his son. And Joab, this man that I don't know what he looked like, but I think he was a pretty fearsome person. And Joab went in and he told David, he said, look, would you be happy if Absalom was alive and I was dead and all of your men were dead? Would that make you happy? You need to get out there and encourage your men. They feel like they put their life on the line, and here you're weeping because your enemy is dead. So David did. He braced up and he went out and met the people. That's the 19th chapter. And David then began in the 19th chapter his return to Jerusalem. And there were many people that had taken Absalom's side that came to him repenting and asking for mercy and being willing to submit themselves to David's authority on his in his journey back to Jerusalem. I don't know what you think, but I think that everything was in an uproar. Everything was in an uproar. And 2 Samuel, the 19th chapter, would like to turn and read just a couple verses, beginning in 41. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away and have brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over Jordan? And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is near of kin to us. David was of the tribe of Judah, see. Wherefore then be ye angry for this matter? Have we eaten at all of the king's cost? Or hath he given us any gift? And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 parts in the king, 10 tribes, see. And we have also more right in David than ye. Why then did ye despise us that our advice should not be first have had in bringing back our king? And the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. So do you see the picture of unrest? Do you see the picture of disturbance? Do you see this? Did it all start because of David and Bathsheba? Did it all start because of that? I think it was a component. But I don't know if that was all the reason. I'm just telling you that this was a terrible... The devil had capitalized on everything he could to cause... this was an outright argument and confrontation. Any time it says the words of one group of men were more fierce than the other, that sounds like they were shouting at one another. That sounded like that was a downright... argument. It was a confrontation. It was not a pretty sight. It was not I love you, brother. It was, you're doing wrong. That's what it was, you see. And that's what the enemy wants to instigate in every saint of God's life. He wants to get us, instead of looking at one another as brothers and sisters, He wants to get us to looking at one another and saying fierce words. I don't know what you think a fierce word would be, but to me it's an attack word. It's something that ridicules somebody else or their decision or tears them down or makes them question their integrity with God. It's not edifying. It's not uplifting. There could be real failures. David had a real failure. Absalom had a real failure. You know, when you try to uproot what God has anointed and put in place, that's the wrong thing to do. But to argue about it just adds fuel to the fire. So we have a setting here that's very chaotic at best. It is not, it's not a happy time. So I'd like for us now, turn another page. Let's go to the 20th chapter. And we're going to read here in the first verse. And there happened to be there a man of Belial. A man of Belial is a man, according to the dictionary, or the Hebrew dictionary for this word Belial, is I thought I wrote the definition down here. Belial means evil, naughty, ungodly men, or wicked. All right? Did you know that unrest, division, problems is always the product of the devil? It's always a product of Belial. And it says here, there happened to be there a man of Belial whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. One comment I found about this is that Saul was a Benjamite, and Saul's lineage was not king any longer. And this man may have went all... You know how a new problem can reopen an old grievance? You know, if you've had a problem in the past with somebody, and maybe you forgive and forget and all of those things that you thought everything was taken care of and covered, and if that person comes along and mashes your finger in the door or something like that, it's like, oh... I knew that fella had it in for, I just knew we didn't have, you know, and that old grievance of years ago can come back up. And I believe that this Sheba, I think that he probably, some of his justifying of what he's fixing to say and what he's fixing to do, I think because of the present circumstances and condition and state of affairs where people were arguing and fiercely contesting one another. David had a failure. Absalom had a failure. Amnon had failure in his life. There was unrest. There was the wisest man around because he sounds like some kind of child going off and pouting or something. But this was serious. This is an adult. He went off and hung himself because they wouldn't listen to him out of spite, I guess. I don't know, but here in this Sheba here, all of the current things were causing his, he was all distressed and turmoil, and he was under the influence of Belial. He said he was a son of him. He'd given himself over to the enemy, and that's what the enemy wants, is all he's got to do is get one or two that gives himself over to the enemy, and what do you know? We got a real problem on our hands. And that's what happened here. Belial had got in control of Sheba. Sheba's thinking all the way back, probably, well, wouldn't have all this trouble if Saul was still king or Saul's sons were king. And what if Jonathan had been king instead of... I don't know what all was going on in his mind. But listen, what he did. He blew a trumpet. That was a signal. You know, we get signals every once in a while. Your cell phone, you know, I hope you got them turned off or turned down, but they'll make a noise. And people have died for those things. Somebody's calling. And maybe you've got it set because it's a special ring, because it's your spouse or it's your brother or something like that. Oh, that's my brother calling. I got to get that one. And maybe you get a special, another little jingle when you get a text message or something like that. He just blew a trumpet. Same thing as we're doing today. He blew a trumpet. He got everybody's attention and said, "We have no part in David." Now, we're going to just put it all out in the open. "We have no part in David, neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse." Jesse was David's father. "Every man to his tents, O Israel." Just go home and be shed of all of this uproar. We don't have to be part of this. I enjoy arguments and trouble about like I do an ingrown toenail. I don't. I don't like being part of somebody disagreeing, whether I'm a bystander or they're just disagreeing with me. I don't like to be part. I don't like to see people fussing. And this guy didn't either. And he said, I don't want nothing to do with this. Let's just go home. You go to your place, I'll go to mine. Let's go to our own homes. I don't even have an inheritance in this. There are many things that will encourage and suggest to us today that we go our separate ways. The devil will be faithful to point things out. A good reason for you to pack your stuff and go home to your tent. You know, this chapter ends. With Sheba, he got on the run. There's a lot of details we could go over, but maybe for the sake of time, we won't. But he was on the run, and David had trouble because of the circumstances. He had trouble organizing an effort to go after Sheba. He sent a command. Let's get everybody together. We got to go stop this fella. This is going to be worse than Absalom trying to take over. It's going to do us more damage if we don't take care of this. And it didn't happen as quickly as it should. And he got inside of a city walls, a city that had a wall around it, the city of Abel. And Joab took the men of David and he went to the city. And this is the story where Joab commenced to trying to knock the walls down because Sheba was in there. And there was a wise woman that came to the top of the wall and began to talk to him and said, What are we doing here? What's the dilemma? What's the problem? And Joab stopped his assault, communicated to her, and she said, "I know what to do. We'll go cut his head off and throw it over the wall." And they fixed the problem. They fixed that problem. Do you think that all of the problems went away? There was still a lot of unrest in that nation because of the circumstances and things that had developed. But I want to tell you, folks, we've got to be determined to cut the head off of the thing that's instigating the unrest. That's saying, "I don't have any business being part of this. Just take your stuff and go home. Pick up your little cushion you sat on and go to the house." It's whatever the devil wants to tell you. I want to tell you, we're going to have to take the head off of that thing. Spring is on us. You know, I believe that the fields are white in the harvest. There's souls out there that need the gospel message. You know, there's souls in our neighborhood that need the gospel message. They need to see a united body that's working together, every joint supplying that which is his part They need to see that. They need to see us working like a well-oiled machine. They need to say, I don't know what they're doing over there, but I want some of that. That's what they need to see. But you know what the devil wants to do? The devil wants to have a son of Belial. He wants to have a Sheba that says, and I know we got, there's things all around us that causes us to feel distressed. There's failures all around. But folks, listen, we've got, there's a cause. You know, David, he could have went down there to the battle with Goliath, and he could have looked at Goliath and heard his brothers and heard all the other soldiers saying, yeah, look how big he is, and yeah, he talks real gruff, and my, look at the size of his spear and his shield and his sword. And wow, that's absurd to think one of us would take on him. And David could have said, I'm going back to the sheep. I'm not staying around here. You know, you guys take care of this. I'm going back. But he didn't. What did David say? Is there not a cause? There's a reason I'm involved in this thing. There's a reason that you stay up and prepare to give something to the congregation. There's a reason that you prepare for to teach a Sunday school class. There's a reason that we endeavor to sing the songs and to be prepared to pray and to be prepared to do whatever needs to be done and to cut the grass or whatever. There's a reason. There's a cause. And the devil knows that, and he tries to spread the trumpet blower that says, I don't want nothing to do with this. I'm going home. The devil knows what he's doing. He's been around a day or two, and he's trying to defeat every, you know, that God is not pleased when a large congregation starts dwindling down. He's not pleased with that. He's not pleased when a small congregation disappears. And in the course of my life, I've seen it happen. Small congregations get kind of fizzle out a little more, and next thing you know, building's for sale. Why? Could it be that the enemy has said, blow your trumpet, let's all go home? I'd like to turn to 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, and read something the Apostle Paul said. First Corinthians, the first chapter, I'm going to read the 10th verse. He says, now I beseech you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you speak the same thing, that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. The Lord wants us. Jesus Christ wants us to be joined together. He don't want us blowing trumpets and saying, take your little cushion and go to the house. That's not what he wants. He wants us to be joined together. He wants us to be unified. He wants us to intimidate the enemy. That's what he wants us to do. He doesn't want us to be intimidated by the enemy. He wants us to intimidate him. God really wants us to intimidate the devil. And we can by the grace and the power of God. I want to read one other verse to you. Psalms 133. Beginning in verse 1. It's a little short psalm, so I'm going to read it all to you. It said, Lord, my heart. I'm sorry, that's not the right one. Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. You know, it's a good thing. It's pleasant for brethren to dwell together in unity. It's like the precious ointment upon the head that ran down upon the beard, even Aaron's beard, that went down to the skirts of his garment. As the dew of Hermon, and as the dew that descended upon the mountains of Zion, for there the Lord commanded the blessing, even life forevermore. What's life forevermore? That's eternal life, isn't it? Where does the Lord command eternal life? It's where brethren dwell together in unity. Where does he want the message of eternal life to be handed to people? It's in that kind of atmosphere. He wants the church to be effective. He wants the buds that's out there in our community, in our neighbor. He wants them to blossom. He wants them to be grafted in. You know, that's another message. But he wants to graft in all those little buds that's out there in our world of people wanting something to fulfill their hearts and lives. He wants them to be grafted in to the true vine. And how are they going to know if someone doesn't tell them? How are they going to know if we don't present it in a palatable manner? Lord, help us today. I want to say one thing about myself. I don't feel like a king, nor do I want to be acknowledged as a king. But I know this. When I stand here, and in the place that I stand in the congregation, if I don't have my ducks in a row, it's going to cause problems. And I want my life to be clear. And I want to be an example of the believers. And I desire your prayers. I want to seek the Lord this morning and ask Him to help me to be the kind of man He wants me to be. You pray for me.